Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 91, recorded December 5th, 2011.
Fishy greetings, all.
Hello. Today, we will be hearing from Paul in Durham in the UK, and from Juliet in Paris, in France again, and from Nigel in Bridport in the UK.
Indeed. So, let's start out with Paul. Well, thanks for coming back on and contributing, Paul. He had some interesting experiences recently. He just had a power cut. His power lines were damaged due to heavy winds.
Which is funny that everybody had heavy winds at the same time, whether you're in the same part of the world or not. It was crazy over here, too.
Yeah,
I actually heard on the radio the day after we had them here, somebody reported seeing a trampoline being blown across the road.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
It's crazy. So, Paul has two tanks, a 5-gallon with the cherry shrimp he got from Mick, and a 32-gallon community tank. And he says, this is a quote, "You can imagine my horror of not really knowing what to do to keep temperatures in the tanks from dropping too much, what with no Google."
What did we do before the internet to obtain information?
So, he had some empty soda bottles, and he came up with a plan, filling them with hot water.
That is a pretty good
idea. Yeah, it is a good idea. Kept filling them with hot water every now and then, and that helped the 32-gallon tank from fluctuating too much, but it was a lot harder with the 5-gallon. And luckily, the power was only off for 4.5 hours, so it wasn't too bad. And it must have been pretty cool weather. But I guess this season for that kind of weather, where that can be a problem. And he said, "Not sure if you spoke about this scenario on the podcast before, and just wondered if you had any helpful advice on the subject." Well, we've spoken a bit about power outages before, and about
it always bears revisiting.
Uninterruptible power supplies, which can be nice, so on. That's true. So, first of all, good on you for that solution with the soda bottles. I mean, that's one of the best things that you can do in a situation like that, is just to put some warm water in the bottles, and that can help.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And others do that same sort of thing with success. But you've also highlighted a key issue that relates to that, is that larger bodies of water, including aquaria, lose heat much more slowly than smaller ones. So you had a lot more trouble keeping the 5-gallon warm than you did with the 32. So that's just something to be aware of in the aquarium world, that you know that you're going to have more difficulties with the smaller tanks. Like, we had a power outage, when was it, last winter, right? Where I didn't even have to worry about our 55.
Yeah, it was fine.
The temperature dropped a bit, but not too much, maybe 4 degrees, which, you know, you can, with the kinds of fish we had in there, it wasn't too much of a problem. But some of the other tanks, it was a little bit more difficult with smaller tanks. Anyway, beyond what you did, there are a few other things that you can do too, but I think, once again, what you did was useful. But insulating the tank can help slow heat loss, and there are a lot of ways to do that. Of course, you should keep the cover on the tank, because the more the, especially if there's cool air moving across the water, that can really cool the water more quickly, so you don't want to do that. That's why we use those fans across the top of water in like a reef tank to keep the water cool. So that happens, it's an evaporative cooling situation, essentially, so that happens very quickly. So try to avoid air moving across the top of the tank, of course. You can also insulate the tank walls and bottom. Of course, you don't want to insulate the bottom by draining the water out, but if you've already insulated the tank by putting a layer of, say, polystyrene on the bottom of the tank, as some people do, just to even
like
out...
Like as you were making your decorations in the tank, you mean? Or
I mean under the tank.
Oh, I see.
Which people often use anyway,
like
just
foam,
to insulate the bottom and to also help against, you know, slight imperfections or inequalities in the surface they're sitting on. Or on the floor under the stand or whatever.
The floor's not quite even.
Can help equal things out a little bit. But I think it was one of our listeners a while ago recommended keeping, and I can't remember who it is, so I apologize if you're listening, and even if you're not, about putting polystyrene sheets that you fit. You know, you cut them to fit on all of your glass panels. Not just the bottom, but the front and the sides and the back.
So making a styrofoam cooler?
In a way, yeah.
Except to be a heater.
Right, and you keep...
You just put them up when the power's out.
You just put them up when the power's out. You keep them in the garage or something.
Tank or something.
Right. And just keep them out of the way, except when something happens, and then you tape them on the outside. And then you can put a couple of towels over the top. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there you go. That'll help. That'll help.
That's a good idea.
Keep things
the
from cooling
off
too
longer.
Fast. Right. It depends
sometimes
on how long.
You don't know how long it's going to be off. So.
Right. But if the power's off for half an hour, it's not going to be a big deal for most situations. But if it's going to be off for a couple of days,
then
you know,
it's...
And, you, of course, like you just pointed out, you never know. So mm-hmm. you might as well be prepared. And you can use other things, too. I mean, I've heard of people just using towels. And piles
around.
Of cloth, whatever, around the tank. Whatever you can use that is a good insulator is, you know, better than nothing. And one important thing to realize, too, if you're in an area where you're planning on losing power a lot, not on purpose, but it's an area where you know you're going to suffer power outages and you have weather where that is a problem, then acrylic tanks might be a better...
Do they hold the heat better?
They do. The acrylic itself is better insulated than glass.
Interesting.
So that might be something to think about.
I would imagine, too, that if someone knows they're going to be in an area where the power goes out frequently, is there... Didn't we talk about alternate power sources for fish tanks at one point?
We did a while ago, yes.
Or at least something to prevent surges so the filters don't die. Didn't we talk about that?
Yeah, we talked about using a battery-powered pump. You can keep the airflow going a little bit in the tank, which can be good. Of course, planted tanks are more resilient when power goes out, mm-hmm. just so everyone knows. Heavily planted tanks tend to be more resilient. They can absorb some things and so on. Of course, if they're in the dark, then they're going to be producing CO2 and using oxygen, and that's not quite as good. But in general, if you have a tank with plants in it and you lose your filter, mm-hmm. you can plan on it lasting a little while longer before it goes down the tubes, so to speak, then you could with a tank without plants. But also, besides a battery-powered air pump, you can also look into an uninterruptible power supply, like the one we have our computer hooked up to. Mm-hmm. We did lose power during a podcast once. Some of you may recall that. And it began beeping, and
fun.
We had to save it and shut down the computer. But at least it didn't
die
completely.
It gives
completely.
You that,
it gives
that
you
warning.
That window.
You can shut it down.
But with some things like a battery-powered air pump, it might last a little longer than a computer. Mm-hmm. You're hooked into one of those power supplies, or even a hang on the back power filter. So that is an option, although disclaimer here, most of them say don't use next to an aquarium, so there you go. So I don't actually recommend it officially. but you might be able to find some that are safe for an aquarium. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, hopefully that sort of covers the bases a little bit for
what
that, Paul,
next?
And thank you, Paul, for your comments and ideas.
We heard from Juliet again in Paris.
Yes. She said that she was initially going to ask a simple question about Java ferns, but was having a serious shrimp problem. So, all of you shrimpers out there, I mean people who keep them, not people who habitually eat them.
No.
Although sometimes they might be the same people, I don't know. I need to send out the call, because this is a shrimp problem that may require your advice. I mean, I keep shrimp too, but this one I have some ideas on, but any other ideas would be welcome. Okay, we're going to hold off on the Java fern question for now and do that after, but...
We'll do the shrimp first.
Yeah, we'll do the shrimp first. She says that she had originally 5 shrimp, and they had reproduced and so on, including 2 males she had for over a year and the 3 females... the new females that she had recently purchased, and they had about 20-something babies, but recently she's been noticing a dead shrimp in the tank every 2 days or so.
Oh, sad.
And she thought something was wrong with the water, so she increased the water changes a bit. She rinsed off the sponge from the sponge filter, but it was an old aquarium water, which is, of course, the correct way to do that, to keep the bacterial colonies intact. And she was wondering if it was just too dirty to process anything, you know, too gummed mm-hmm. up with...
Too
with,
clogged.
Yeah. Just solid waste materials. Then she decided to change small amounts of water using mineral water with a pH of 7 just to ensure there was nothing toxic in the tap water, despite using a water conditioner. But she saw another shrimp dead after she did that. And she figures it was too far gone from whatever was killing them, or the water, you know, the mineral water wasn't the issue there. And she says it's nearly always a buried female. In other words, one that's carrying fertilized eggs. And she's wondering if there's a mineral deficiency of some kind. She's wondering about that. She says the big females seem to have a white line going across their backs from side to side as if they were going to split their shells. Because, you know, females often have a lighter line down the middle of their backs. A dorsal stripe, so to speak.
But this is more lateral? It's going from one side to the other?
Yeah, seems to go from one side to the other. So she's wondering if that was in preparation of a molt, but she's wondering if it's something else. And the diet she gives them are algae wafers and 1/6 of a NovoTab by JBL. And she gives that to them every day. Those are tablets for bottom feeding fish. She says they love those and they eat them, but she's wondering if there's something in them that gradually poisons them.
Or if it's missing something.
And, yeah, she's wondering about the mineral deficiency as well. And she said she's calling out to the serious shrimp guys listening. She's wondering if she's feeding too much. They always do away with the food within 30 minutes. And she's sad about this. She hates keeping animals in the wrong conditions and doesn't want to give up on shrimp, but she will if she has to. But she'd be very sad to do so. So I sent her an email in response. This was earlier in the week. And I talked about a few things, which I'll reiterate a bit here. I've seen something similar to this shrimp die-off situations a couple of times in the past 7 years or so that I've been keeping red cherry shrimp. And in each case that I can recall, it had something to do with water quality, so that may still be an issue. I'm not sure how large your water changes were, and that may be something to look at. But and you were addressing a lot of those things correctly, like rinsing the sponge filter off and so on. And I asked her what the depth and makeup of her substrate was, because that could be important. And the pH of the shrimp aquarium, I was wondering if that still tests the same as the tap. If we noticed a really big change, we might suspect some issues going on, and we might be able to narrow it down a little bit. And I said, even though I'm not a big user of activated carbon, in a case like this, I might get one of those air-driven box corner filters and put some activated carbon in, just in case there are traces of heavy metals like copper in the water, because shrimp are very susceptible to heavy metals.
And the carbon would help absorb that.
And that's good at getting rid of them, yeah. And most shrimp people these days consider an iodine or iodide supplementation unnecessary if the diet is balanced. But I've found that when I put a few square centimeters of nori, you know, the seaweed you use to make sushi.
Wrap around sushi, yeah.
Right, and I would use organic because the other kind can have heavy metals in it. If you add that to the tank weekly, it makes a big difference in terms of vitality, breeding, molting, success of the shrimp.
As long as you're at it, you know, shove some of it in your own mouth, too, because it's good for you.
I like to eat it straight.
He makes just, like, he folds up a whole square and just eats it like a
cracker.
A sushi cracker sandwich.
I'm a little weird that way. I've developed
a taste for it. I only
like
it around my sushi.
Developed a taste for it in Hawaii and just can't get away from this stuff.
They have nori-flavored popcorn.
In Hawaii.
They really do.
Yeah, it was exciting. But here we go. I just think it's a fairly natural and safe way to add iodide, whatever, to the diet of the shrimp, and they seem to benefit from it, never seem to be harmed by it, and I really did notice that it can help with their molting. So I will hopefully think of some more ideas, but I'm putting out the call again for shrimper input, anybody who can
give
some ideas. So we hope that works out. She did respond saying that they're in a nano tank of 20 liters.
How many gallons is that?
Isn't that about 5 gallons?
About 5 gallons?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know how many.
I think that's about 5 gallons. But about probably closer to 15 when on the wood and gravel are counted. 15 liters.
Okay.
There's about an inch of gravel, and it's impossible to vacuum it. There's quite a lot of plant debris from those Indian almond leaves, or whatever they are called.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of that? And if I only have a sponge filter, how can I use carbon? Can I just put a handful in pantyhose or something like that for 48 hours? And I had some ideas for her. One is that if it's in a nano tank that's so small, not that you can't do shrimp in a smaller tank, but they're just harder. Just because
it's harder to keep the conditions stable?
Yeah, water quality issues can be hard. We're going to have a break just about now, and we'll come back to that.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay. So we were talking about the different ideas for how to help these shrimp out.
And how to put the carbon in.
And how to put the carbon in and so
right.
on. Okay, one thing is the gravel, the inch of gravel. I'm not sure what kind of gravel it is.
Well, you were talking about the size of the tank. Were you suggesting a bigger setup
is
needed?
I'm suggesting a bigger setup is easier to maintain the water quality for the shrimp. Not that it's impossible to do in a 5 gallon. People do it. But
it's just more complicated.
I have some shrimp, some red cherry shrimp in a 5 gallon with some African dwarf frogs, and they're breeding in there not as well as they would be without the frogs because, you know, they eat them, but to some extent, but the numbers are increasing. So it's possible. It's heavily planted tank and so on, but, you know, it's just harder. I've found they're nearly maintenance-free in a larger tank, almost. I shouldn't say maintenance-free, but they're just easier in a larger tank. So there's about an inch of gravel that's impossible to vacuum. Now, that can be, you know, you can have a situation where you just sort of get the detritus off the surface that comes up when you're vacuuming and not actually vacuuming the gravel itself. But if there's any sort of substrate where things are not being vacuumed, the potential for issues exist. Certain bacterial processes.
Things get trapped down there and create more ammonia?
Well, sometimes that can happen. Yeah, you can get ammonia being an issue. Sometimes it's not even that, but it is, depending on how, the degree of oxygen that's in that substrate. It's only an inch, so it's not super deep, but it's possible to get anoxic and anaerobic pockets, and if you get too anaerobic, you can get certain bacteria that will produce hydrogen sulfide, and that's really toxic.
And what does hydrogen sulfide do?
Well, it smells like rotten eggs. You've smelled it before.
Oh.
Marsh gas, you know, when you go visit a swamp.
Stinky stuff.
Yeah. Like, the last time we went to the Great Salt Lake, you smelled hydrogen sulfide
it's
in the mud.
It's always there. It stinks.
Right. And it's very toxic, even in small concentrations. So, if some of it is being produced because of substrate where there are anaerobic pockets, that's a bad thing. That could definitely account for the shrimp deaths. Another thing that Juliet mentioned, is about the Indian almond leaves. Now, Indian almond leaves are great water conditioners, but depending on the quantity and so on, that could cause a pH drop. And that could be an issue, depending on the situation. But these leaves do decrease the pH of the water they're in. They tend to. And I'm not sure of the quantities used and so on, but a water change with, if you have the Indian almond leaves in there to a certain, you know, in the kind of a high concentration of that, it will reduce the pH. The ammonia will not be toxic. But then you do a water change with water from the tap that's at pH of 8, and you could have some pH shock, or you could have some, if there's a little ammonia in there, ammonium ions could become ammonia ions and, you know, cause damage that way. So those are some possibilities as well. But with the carbon, I wouldn't use carbon in just like pantyhose or anything, because you really want the water to flow through it. And with pantyhose, you really can't get it to do that. It's not going to work very well.
It just sits there as a big lump?
Right. So I would see if you can get a box filter, a hang-on-the-back filter with a media bag attachment and put it in there. And I know finding a hang-on-the-back filter that fits a 5 gallon tank is not the easiest thing in the world, but some of them have adjustable flow rates, and you can turn it down and then just run it through the media bag, and that could help, possibly, if you know, heavy metals are the issue. So there are some ideas. And hopefully we'll hear from our shrimper friends about what we can do about that.
So good luck.
Yes, we hope it goes well. Please keep us updated.
Now, are we going to talk about Java ferns, too?
Yeah, we're going to talk about Juliet's Java ferns issue. Now, something she mentioned about the Java ferns is that when she tries to grow them, They don't seem to work very well. They don't grow in her tanks. She sees these big, fantastic Java friends in the
shops. Any of them, or just in this little 5-gallon?
Well, she says tanks, plural.
Oh, okay.
She's got a couple of tanks.
So any of them.
And she says hers survive, but they never, ever grow big. And they don't die, exactly, but the leaves get black and spotty pretty quickly. And they never, ever seem to grow big, even though they continually sprout little baby plants on the edges of the dead-looking ones. And she's wondering what's wrong. She's tried dosing with Excel, but that killed her Vallisneria plants when she increased the dosage and didn't do anything at the regular dose for her Java ferns. And she would love to have a jungle of them because they're absolutely beautiful and they grow well. And I would say there's a lot of things to think about with Java ferns, but of course Java ferns are supposed to be a tough plant. And they are in a lot of ways, but there are some things that can be a problem. When the leaves start to go black and die, I mean, that's a natural process that occurs, but it occurs fairly slowly. Any given plant doesn't do it very often when it's healthy, but it does do it once in a while. The leaves will die off slowly and be replaced by other ones, and it's very natural for those black leaves to send off little plantlets. But it's usually a last-ditch effort for survival and propagation for that particular leaf, and it's happening a lot with the plants. There's something, you know, that's bugging them, obviously. And it sounds like it's happening too frequently, so let's look at some ideas. Now, one, we need to look at how you received the Java ferns and what state the Java ferns were when you found them or when you purchased them. Because in my experience, relatively few stores treat them properly when they're in the store, and that can pass the problems on to you. A lot of times they'll try to put the rhizome, which is the creeping green structure at the base of the plant that look kind of like a cross between stems and roots. And they throw the leaves up. They'll put those in the substrate.
It looks kind of like a horizontal trunk.
Yeah, kind of like that. And that's not the proper way for a Java fern to grow, with the rhizome in the substrate. So if they're kept that way for any length of time, they will begin to decline and eventually die. I mean, you can often recover one from the store that's been there for a couple of weeks, pull it out, and it'll be okay. But if it's been there too long, it'll just start to kill the plant. And the rhizomes are actually anchoring structures, and in the wild, they crawl along the surfaces of rocks or wood or different things, even out of the water. And
just to grip things.
Yeah, they grip. And they're the body of the plant from which the leaves sprout, as well as the roots. Now, the true roots are black and thread-like, and those can go into soil, they can go into substrate, whatever. But I wouldn't even plant them myself, because I would...
They just crawl in themselves?
Yeah, yeah. And I anchor the rhizomes to a piece of rock or driftwood with an elastic band that's snug but not too tight. Or you can use thread, you know, cotton thread that'll eventually decompose and disappear. And by the time it has, or by the time,
the plant,
you know, in a few weeks, the plant will have gripped itself onto the rock or the driftwood or whatever. And then I just let the black roots find their way into the substrate. So if you happen to receive your plants potted or purchase them when their rhizomes were buried, that may be reason enough for the issues, if that's how you're getting them. And maybe it's not, but that's just one thing to think about to start out with. But let's assume, for now, that your Java ferns are properly attached to a piece of rock or whatnot, and they were when you purchased them. They were not improperly treated in terms of the rhizomes, but they're still not thriving. A couple of other things we can look at. I remember reading a very old post about Java ferns years ago, and it said, my Java ferns started doing really well when I kept them at a lower temperature. So look at the temperature. See if you can do a tank with a cooler temperature. Sometimes that can help. I've noticed my Java fern tanks with cooler temperatures often really thrive. They can do well at warmer temperatures, too. I mean, people keep them in discus tanks, because discus like the water really warm, like 86, 87 degrees, you know, but they'll do fine there. But sometimes, just changing the conditions, you can see how well your particular Java ferns do. Now, besides Excel, are you using other fertilizers, trace element mixes, or iron supplements, or anything like that?
Shouldn't
that might
be
useful to know. Java ferns don't necessarily require it. I've seen Java ferns thrive in almost any situation. Like, an example would be, do you remember when we set up that tank for Julie and Justin? For their betta?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I gave them some Pellia and some Java fern, needle leaf Java fern. And they just had one betta in about 2 gallons of water. They had up on their shelf, and it got some window light, and that was it. never fertilized it or anything. And we set that up for them because their beta was in a different container, and we set that up. And then about a couple months after that, maybe 3 months after that, we came back and visited them, and it had overtaken the tank, and it was going crazy and looking really good. But they had never fertilized. It was just the fertilizer was beta waste, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't necessarily need it, but sometimes it can help, especially depending on what's going on in the rest of the tank. If the tank is full of other fast-growing stem plants, for example, they might be taking all the nutrients. I've had tanks where I've had, you know, fast-growing plants other than the gel fern, because they're not particularly fast-growing, and they were growing so fast that they were taking up the nutrients that the Java ferns couldn't get enough. And so I had to...
So just being outcompeted.
Outcompeted. So I had to add other supplementation. So that might be an idea, too, to think about. And, of course, they don't need a lot of light. In fact, they can do well with very little light compared to a lot of other plants. But if other plants are outcompeting them or even shading them too much, that could be an issue. So let us know how that goes, and hopefully that will help. Maybe there are some ideas there that can be useful. But one more thing is that I have found it that Java ferns do better for me if I do have an enriched substrate like fluorite, even though they might not be in it. They might be growing on a piece of driftwood or something like that. But there are processes that occur in a substrate, a mineral-enriched substrate like fluorite, which is a brand name produced by C-Chem. There are others out there. There's EcoComplete, and there's laterite, and so on. But if you use something like that, they just seem to do better. Not that they can't do well without it, but in my experience, they do better with it. So it might be worth looking at your substrate as well and seeing what you got. Okay.
Alrighty, we're going to go to Nigel in Bridport in the UK.
Mm-hmm. He just listened to episode 90 and was thinking, he was hoping the customs would work out. We do have good news for you, Nigel.
We sent it.
Yeah, we finally got it sent out. It should be there in a week or two, probably less than 2 weeks.
They said 7 to 10 days.
7 to 10 days from now. So we finally got your package out, and hopefully it goes through customs. We'll keep our fingers crossed that they'll let it through. And, yeah, just let us know when it gets there. And he said that the convicts that he mentioned previously have spawned, and they have free-swimming fry, but they're in a friend's tank now because he traded them out for 4 yellow lab cichlids, the Mbunas,
one of the most
popular ones. Yeah, he said he got 2 females and 2 males that are proven breeding group, and he built a rack to hold 2 3-foot tanks to help with tank space when they decide to breed, which probably won't be very long, especially if they're already a breeding group. And he made the whole thing himself, which is pretty amazing. He took several hours of cutting, notching, and screwing, looks like 4x2s and 3x4-inch pieces of wood and so on. And he even found room to put a little 2-gallon tank on the top shelf with it.
Oh, cool.
And he attached a photo of it so we can see what he's done. So we'll put that on the resources page.
Lovely.
You can check that out. And thank you for sending that, Nigel. It'll be fun to follow the saga of your yellow lab cichlids. And he said the color in the water in the lower tank is just because the black gravel he had just put in was washed, but not quite enough. So he only found that out after adding the water, and that's, you know, fairly normal for that to happen, but it'll clear soon. So, yeah, we'd love to see how that pans out with your yellow lab cichlids, and please keep us posted on your try-ops that are now in the post.
Indeed.
And that is about it for this week, ladies and gentlemen. We will continue with another exciting episode.
Same fish channel, same fish time.
Yeah. May the fish be with you. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.